And welcome to Lunch with Leon, my regular podcast, where I invite you to join me for lunch with one of my guests from around the world of transport. Lunch with Leon is brought to you by Total Care, the experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Total Care has been supporting the passenger and commercial transport industry for decades, supplying their popular mobile column lifts in the UK. So last week, we started off the new year in a different way, thinking about entrepreneurs and leadership qualities, especially for those in the early stages of their journey. This week, we are literally switching tracks, and we're going to talk about railways. So I wonder how many of you have heard of Ricardo, the famous automotive company that in the 1920s refined the diesel engine so it could be used in commercial vehicles. In fact, his history goes back even further than that. It was during the First World War, the government got Harry Ricardo, and of course he got knighted for this, got Harry Ricardo to take steps to stop British battle tanks giving away their locations by blowing out so much black smoke. But Ricardo has many more business interests than that, and it was really good to catch up with a favourite dining guest of mine, Paul Seller, the Managing Director of Ricardo Rail. Okay, Paul, so what does Ricardo Rail do?
Well, in fact, Ricardo wasn't in the rail industry particularly at all until about 5 years ago. And you probably might have heard that over the previous century, Ricardo had been responsible for developing a lot of drive lines, particularly diesel engines. And, you know, over the years had helped manufacturers to develop diesel engines for traction applications. So it kind of dallied around the edges, you know, until about 2015. And then Ricardo looked at trying to get into the market much more dramatically. And very fortuitously at that time, Lloyd's Register was selling its rail business, for which I was the managing director. And we went through a sale process and we were bought by Ricardo. And so it kind of got lock, stock and barrel into, I guess, two key things initially, which was a lot of work around independent assurance, you know, certifying new railways around the world, new systems, particularly high-end systems like communication and control systems, new traction and rolling stock, but also being on the other side of the fence and doing a lot of the system engineering, a lot of the design and development of those things. And that had been pretty much what we as a going concern had been doing from, I guess, 2001-ish anyway. And so that's what we've been doing for the last 5 years now in our new guise as Ricardo Rail. But that would be underselling, I think, actually what Ricardo does in totality, if you look at its 3,000 people in total, because I'm only a fifth of that. We are about 600 people in the rail team. And the thing about Ricardo, I guess, and we might talk about this later on, is that, of course, the whole issue of decarbonisation is coming along, and the whole issue of environmental control and clean air. And the other divisions of Ricardo have got a big part to play in that, you know, in the railway world, because we've got at the one end of the spectrum our environmental business that is helping organisations and governments all over the world, you know, develop plans and policies for how it manages its environmental impact in particular. And that's all the way down to kind of understanding what the carbon footprint looks like for their operations, but also how their supply chains and the impact not just of them, but all the people that supply them, does to the work that they do. But also on what was the propulsion, well, I guess many years ago would have been the diesel and driveline side of the business, or the internal combustion engine and driveline side of the business, is a propulsion world. And that team, which is still the best part of 1,500 people, is pretty much half of what Ricardo does around the world, very much turn their attention to life after the internal combustion engine. And so that's, I guess, where we really need to push as a business now, because we have, you know, in my team, I would say very enviable rail domain knowledge around the world. When you couple that with a global leading propulsion team that really understand how you are electrifying what were previously internal combustion engine driven regimes, and creating hybrid drivelines or ammonia powered drivelines or hydrogen powered drivelines, and you know, or just pure EV kind of battery pack drivelines, that's Ricardo's raison d'etre. And so, you know, for the coming years, I personally would like to think that if there's one thing that Ricardo gets renowned for, it's as the kind of spiritual next step of where it came from. It came from the internal combustion engine world. I'm really hoping that it moves on and becomes synonymous with the post-internal combustion engine environment of electrification and hydrogen and ammonia and other clever propulsion mechanisms that power, you know, the world's industries.
I often think about this. Every time there's been a threat to the internal combustion engine, what have we got back was cleaner diesel. Because every time the world, you know, came forward with CNG and LPG and various early forms of battery and so on, the oil companies cleaned up their act, the engine companies cleaned up their act, and we got clean diesel.
Yeah.
And to be fair, although the politicians hate this, the emissions from a Euro 6 diesel engine are nothing short of miraculously low. I mean, the drawback is in politics, diesel bad, electric good. So I think this time it's real. You know, with your international interest on rail, are other countries as excited about the decarbonisation agenda as we are?
I think parts of Europe are and parts of North America are, Leon. But to be honest, I think it's really important that we understand that different parts of the world are at a different stage in what the future looks like. And frankly, you know, for a large part of the world that we cover, particularly places like Asia, you know, big developing economies, they are still very much emerging from having way too little commuter railway. And they're focusing on things like building metro railways, building light rapid transit systems and so on. And for those organizations and for those countries, decarbonization is still a long way off. And so it's really important that, you know, we don't get to thinking that everybody wants to jump on the decarbonization bandwagon. It is a very Western-oriented view of the world. And so we do have to, a bit like, you know, Janus, the Roman god, we're two-faced. We've got to look in one direction for decarbonizing existing mature railway organizations that in some cases have been around for 180 years. But in the other direction, we've got to look for new organizations, emerging companies, and companies which, frankly, are much, much more focused on just getting the infrastructure built in the first place. And decarbonization is still something that, you know, it's on the to-do list. It's something they're going to be doing quite a few years from now, I suspect.
Yeah, so somebody, I can't remember who now, somebody famously said that the Stone Age didn't end because they ran out of stone, and the Oil Age isn't going to end because we've run out of oil. I think the projections for oil is about 45 years.
Yeah, yeah.
But that just assumes the current rate of growth. The fact is that the demand for oil is going to reduce. So it will last longer. And indeed, with fracking and other forms, we'll find a bit more yet, won't we?
I think so. You know, you said something earlier as well, which I want to come back to, Leon, which is I do think that in the rush to remove fossil fuel from the energy mix, that the internal combustion engine as a mechanism, what is it? It's a mechanical construct, right, that is these days governed by a lot of very clever electronics, but it's essentially a means of combusting an energy source. And it does seem to have got wrapped into this idea that fossil fuels are bad, therefore internal combustion engines are bad. And so a lot of politicians, certainly in the West, seem to be keen to tar the internal combustion engine with the same brush as the fuel that it uses. Whereas I think we've got to be really careful that there's life in the old dog yet with the internal combustion engine. You know, you talked about, you know, diesel engines, for instance, being EU6 and so on, and producing incredibly low emissions, and that's true. But, you know, internal combustion engines don't have to burn petrol or diesel. They can burn other substances besides. And a really good case in point is hydrogen. there is this general belief, isn't there, that the hydrogen world is only a world associated with the hydrogen fuel cell. But actually, internal combustion engines can burn hydrogen and, in fact, are a very good means of burning hydrogen. A lot of work is now taking place to look at how those engines can in future be modified to be hydrogen burning engines. And then on top of that, you know, there are other possibilities, you know, methane, for instance. I personally, I know it's early days, but I find extremely exciting because as a greenhouse gas, methane is that much more damaging to the environment, whatever that is, you know, 14, 18 times. It's a significant multiple over CO2. And by burning methane that you've captured from agricultural land use, whether that's from, you know, animals or from the rotting of vegetation, you can dramatically improve your carbon footprint. And in fact, if you look at places like California, they now see methane as a fuel source, as carbon negative. So, you know, it kind of occurs to me that we're living in a bit of a Wild West type of environment at the moment, where there's a lot of fluidity, you know, there's a lot of stuff changing that no one's quite certain about exactly what the most appropriate, effective means of energy production is going to look like, even just maybe 10 years from now. And so a lot of different irons are in a lot of different fires. I think it would be really premature for people to assume, as they have done in a lot of cases very officially, that the fuel cell, for instance, is the de facto replacement for the internal combustion engine, certainly in railway terms, away from where you electrify. And I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. I talked to quite a few senior people in the industry who, as yet, actually genuinely believe that outside of electrification, surely the world is either full battery or full hydrogen fuel cell. But that presupposes that we've settled on those as the absolute technological ways forward. And I just don't think that's the case at the moment. And what I'd like to say is I think that's where Ricardo actually has a really important part to play, because, you know, we've almost got to go around educating the users of those power sources to understand that there's still a long way to go to settle on what are the most appropriate means for the future. And it kind of reminds me, and I know we're both transport geeks and we look back to the dawn of the automobile. If you look back to the 1880s, 1890s, and 1900s, there were all manner of different propulsion types around at the time, weren't there? You know, White, as a vehicle manufacturer in the States, were famous for their steam cars. And there was a point until the 1910s when White looked like it could be just as effective a solution for moving people around in the automobile as an internal combustion engine. And that was just one of many. And there were electric vehicles at the time, you know, and it really wasn't for 20 to 30 years until the automobile hit upon the petrol engine as the obvious dominant feature of future personal transportation. And I think we're kind of in a similar environment now with the different fuel types that are coming through. So it would definitely be churlish of us to think that hydrogen fuel cells, for instance, are now the de facto way forward.
So there's some particular challenges, though, aren't there, on rail? Because clearly there's not enough energy density in batteries, on full batteries, to work for rail, is there? Because a train is very heavy and you're compounding it with the weight of batteries. But UK seems to have made rail electrification a rather harder job than it needed to be. The most recent electrification of the Great Western Main Line, of course, is only partial. So we end up with trains with 10 tons worth of diesel engines slung underneath in order to run on the bits that don't have overhead wires. And that seems to me to be a typical British solution, whereby we couldn't justify the cost of the overhead wires at the extremities. So came up with this typical fudge. So rail's a particularly thorny one, isn't it, for decarbonisation and zero emission?
I think so. And, you know, one of the important points, I guess, is the trouble with batteries is that you're constantly lugging that weight around, aren't you? Even when they're reduced in power, you've still got the weight. The mass is always there. And as you say, it creates huge issues with axle loading, which in itself then damages the track more readily, which consumes more asset cost. Of course, batteries bring their own environmental hazards. So batteries are certainly not a panacea. in the future, if you like, of running rail vehicles, certainly in kind of any type of distance. And well, I guess it's true, isn't it? You know, a lot has been said about the fact that we are developing or have developed bimode and trimode vehicles. It does feel, doesn't it, somewhat crazy that we have vehicles that are lugging around batteries, transformers, diesel engines, diesel fuel tanks, and so on, for the sake of trying to be able to cater for all eventualities in a world where, frankly, there should have been continuous electrification on the routes in question. It's a big price to pay in life cycle cost for the duration of those vehicles, which, you know, for those that are listening to this podcast and perhaps don't necessarily understand, these vehicles are designed to last 30 years. And most of these vehicles, well, actually, they typically soldier on for 40 years and in some case 50 years. So what we do as a solution now for electrification and being able to run from A to B at a suitable speed actually is kind of saddling future generations with a bigger problem. So I'm certainly not a fan of that type of solution. I do think we need to be much more strategic in the way that we evaluate the most suitable energy mix, you know, for the type of application.
It is interesting, isn't it? One of the things, somebody told me this, the new aircraft carrier, the Prince of Wales, which is, I think, just on its sea trials at the moment. The last captain of the Prince of Wales, before it is scrapped, has only just been born.
Yes, right.
Because born today, in 35 to 40 years' time, will be the captain of the Prince of Wales before it's scrapped. So how on earth do you design something that is going to last, as the case with rail vehicles, 30 plus years, and somehow keep it going to defray the cost of the asset life over a decent period, at a time when the science is moving so quickly? Everything we know about energy, everything we know about carbon fiber as opposed to metal, as opposed to the way we join things together and so on. All those things are all changing quite rapidly. And it seems almost impossible to conceive that we will still want the existing railway rolling stock 30, 40 years in the future, because the science will have changed so quickly and they'll be out of date. So I'm always fascinated by that. And the other thing I know that works in rail is that, you know, we've just seen the retirement, haven't we, of the rolling stock on the Isle of Wight, which is 82 years old.
Yeah.
But we'll never have those days again, because when that 1938 tube stock was designed, it was designed by men, engineers, with a pen and paper. So they were all grossly overspecified in terms of strength and structural integrity, which means that we've been able to extend and extend and extend the lives for short-term savings. But nowadays with computers, frankly, when any vehicle is being designed, the question comes up, how long do you want it to last for? And if the answer is, say, 25 years, well, the 25 years will be the structural integrity lifespan. And after 25 years, it'll fall over. So that's the other thing. We can't just assume that we will forever be able to run vehicles for longer than their design life, because for the moment, the design life is so long because they were designed before computers did the work for us. Now we know so much more, don't we?
I think so. But, you know, the thing is, Leon, I'm not so sure that if you look at your typical vehicle now, typical passenger coach, an Aventra or a Siemens DeZero City, that actually the fundamentals of those vehicles are any different in that context. When you look at the quality of the body shells and the glazing and the mechanical componentry, these things are, it's not beyond the wit of man to re-engineer them at a half life or even a third life, you know, and to replace the traction systems and put in new train control management systems and so on. I think those things are perfectly possible. You know, a bigger issue seems to me to be this rather bizarre situation that we've had in the UK for a little while now, that perfectly good vehicles, ones that have incredible lifespans, stand on the precipice of no longer being used because of an unusual leasing regime in the UK, where it's just as easy, particularly in this era of low borrowing costs, to go and buy yourself or lease yourself another brand new vehicle.
And indeed, perhaps in the days of franchising, win your franchise because of the factory and the jobs that you promised in a part of the country that was desperate for new jobs. So, I mean, there is, in fact, too much rail capacity in terms of manufacturing in this country, isn't there? Because factories popping up all over the place in order to build one or two orders that have nothing then afterwards unless something else comes along.
It's interesting, isn't it, Leon, you know, because we're both old enough to remember earlier generations of vehicle, and any railway historians amongst us will recall that back in the 1950s and early 60s, when British Rail first went through a major re-equipment of its rolling stock and went from steam locomotion to diesel and electric, there were dozens of different factories all over the UK pumping out really quite small fleet sizes. And out of that grew only a very small number of kind of, if you like, ubiquitous providers of rolling stock, which then amalgamated and ultimately have become the Alstoms and Siemens and so on that we know today. But it seems to me not dissimilar now. You know, we've been through what in the last handful of years, a major re-equipping of passenger rolling stock in the UK, and all manner of new entrants have piled into the marketplace, many of whom have, as you just said, built factories all over the UK. And guess what? By the time those factories are up and running properly, it turns out that, as has always been the case in rail, these equipment procurement exercises go in fits and starts. And I think we're just about to enter a period where quite possibly there'll be a rather barren stretch of new procurement, vehicle procurement. And what does it mean to those factories? I personally can't see many of those factories making it through that phase.
No, indeed. So, Paul, with your international hat on, I mean, the thing we knew before the pandemic was that all the growing cities around the world, especially in the East, if the economy was booming, they were digging metros. And there was a sort of feeling, a bit like we had here for a while, that there is a huge amount of capacity being generated, which in turn will stimulate the economy because it will encourage people to live there, work there, and so on. So is that still the case? Are we still building metros around the world in developing cities?
Oh, yeah. Yes. And I think maybe from our perspective as a business, you know, we were very lucky to be able to support a lot of the metro building that took place fairly early on in places like China and Korea and so on. And those, honestly, a lot of metro construction in countries like China, of which there are dozens, if not hundreds of lines still being built, it is somewhat like shelling peas. And these things are still happening. They're happening at a furious pace to keep up with demand. And even in places that were maybe kind of hitherto very quiet, I mean, and I'll cite Australia as a really good example. You know, until probably 3 or 4 years ago, a lot of companies were pulling out of Australia in railway terms because they said there's not a lot going on. But in fact, you know, the major conurbations in Australia, like Sydney and Melbourne, they've had huge population growth, and they find that they can't support the movement of their populations by road any longer. And so they are scrambling to build new metro railways. So here we are in the middle of COVID, which is dramatically affecting ridership in Europe, for instance. Yet actually, in places like Australia, there are probably more metro and light rapid transit projects than ever before. And they're just continuing unabated. So, you know, my sense looking at a lot of the world, in particular Asia and Australasia, is that it's business as usual, really. And I think it's going to be that for the foreseeable future.
Oh, well, that's good to know, isn't it? Because Ricardo in particular, but the UK in general, has a phenomenal amount of railway expertise, doesn't it? In lots of different areas, whether it's tunnelling, whether it's signalling, whether it's train operation and so on. So that's got to be good for the economy. Just thinking about that, does Brexit have any effect on you?
So, you know, when Brexit first came along 4 years ago, it became pretty clear to us as a provider of independent assurance services that if we were certifying major changes, kind of material changes to Britain's railway system and those across Europe, and we were doing that, by the way, as an accredited provider of notified body and designated body services. These are schemes that are set up and operated by Europe, and we are part of those schemes, that if we did not get those accreditations in mainland Europe, that we would no longer be able to do that work across Europe. So that did represent to us a clear and present danger. We knew that if we didn't get accreditation to be a notified body in Europe, we could lose all of that work at the stroke of midnight whenever Brexit was supposed to come along. And so we put a lot of effort, I dare say, along with a lot of our competitors, into making sure that we were accredited to provide European regulated services such as notified body activity against the interoperability directives in mainland Europe. And it was a hell of a lot of effort and a lot of cost. And it's been interesting, hasn't it? You know, in the last few weeks, we've heard, certainly in the run-up to Christmas and discussions around what the Brexit deal would look like, we heard that what the deal doesn't cover, is European conformity and how you confirm similarity of conformity of your products across Europe. And so what that has meant really in practice for us is making sure that we are able to certify equipment both in the UK. So, you know, we are certified to do that in the UK, but now we are also in parallel certified to do that in Europe. And of course, before the 31st of December, we only needed to do that in the UK, theoretically. You know, we only needed one, if you like, rubber stamping authority internally to do that work. The fact that we've had to set up a parallel regime in mainland Europe, of course, will be a bit of extra ongoing cost and administrative burden. We're not unique. I'm sure there's lots of others. I know there are lots of notified bodies, for instance, in the UK. And I would just hope that they've all done the same thing and managed to get their accreditations in mainland Europe. But other than that, because we effectively have a lot of people that drive desks and laptops and, you know, our knowledge travels across borders through the airwaves. And most of what we know about, you know, train control and vehicles and so on, can be shared around the world from people. And it doesn't really matter where they sit. And I think that's been proven by COVID. You know, outside of those accreditations, actually, we had to do very little, really. We are a very mobile kind of knowledge provider in that sense.
Yeah, it's in everybody's interest to have harmonized standards. So I take the point then that you have to be actually physically, legally certified in each of the territories. But there's no great demand, is there, for us to move away from standard specifications and so on, because the business is global, the economy comes out of scale, and therefore it's got to be the case that a light rail vehicle or a rail vehicle has got to be able to operate in many territories if they're going to be enough of a production run of similar vehicles to make the investment worthwhile. So I guess apart from the having to make sure you're legally certified, for the moment, life goes on broadly the same. Is that right?
I think so, yeah. And you know, it's interesting, isn't it, Leon, because we now operate, you know, you said earlier in this discussion, we were talking about EU6 emissions regs and so on. And of course, those are European emissions regs. And I don't think we have any, in that sense, we don't have any intention of breaking away from the way that Europe measures what constitutes effective or correct emissions. And it's the same with all other walks of life, isn't it? You know, when it comes to railways, the simple fact is that the dominant standard in the world of rail is the Euro norm. And there are several standards that we apply as a business in Ricardo around the world when we're doing railway work. And EN 5126, EN 5128129, the standards that govern the performance of complex systems. Frankly, those standards, they are applied pretty much globally now. If there was a time, of course, we can remember going back 20 to 30 years when pretty much every railway regime around the world had its own custom and practice, had its own standards. Everything was enshrined in hundreds of different documents. And certainly we did that in the UK. But, you know, there has been that migration over the last 30 years towards a very common set of standards. And it is, you know, it's fortuitous, really. It enables us to do work around the world as much, because if we're going to look at a signaling system controlling a metro line in China, guess what? Euro norms apply. And so we have individuals in our Chinese team sitting in Beijing right now who, frankly, are just as capable of evaluating, you know, the compliance of a system developed in Europe for application in, say, the Netherlands or Spain as they could in China. And if you think about it, that's an amazing thing, isn't it? Transportability of standards around the world. I can't see that we are going as a newly, you know, independent sovereign nation to start developing unique and varied railway standards that divert us away from the standards that we've been using for the last few years. I think it's all just going to continue as it is.
Just as a final thought, in aviation, if we look at what's happened in aviation over our lifetime, we have gone from civil aircraft being flown by a crew of three, all of whom were working pretty hard for the journey, to now almost universally with a crew of two, where the computers are doing nearly all the work. And whilst in no way saying anything negative about the capability of the crews at all, but on a typical routine flight, everything about the planning, everything about the journey and so on is broadly handled automatically. In fact, I heard a pilot describe a long-haul flight as being one very long, monotonous monitoring of instruments with a panicky bit at the beginning and a panicky bit at the end.
Yeah.
Are we seeing that in rail as well? Because, you know, we do hear from time to time, don't we, that governments are keen to reduce the dependence on real human labour at the sharp end of a rail vehicle. So are we seeing a similar move in rail to what we've seen in aviation?
So it's a thorny one, isn't it, Leon? You know, you come from a Transport for London background, and I think there have been kind of statements made by Transport for London in recent times about whether or not there would be a concerted effort to introduce driverless trains, you know, as a ubiquitous thing across the network in the future. And I don't think it's necessarily a foregone conclusion that we need or should try to get to a position where our heavy rail networks, you know, maybe our metro systems, but certainly our heavy rail networks no longer require drivers. The trouble is that the systems that you operate in order to avoid having drivers are in themselves incredibly complicated. And it's by no means sure that the human brain has been usurped yet by systems that are good enough to really understand how best you drive complicated, you know, timetabled networks when you get perturbations. I can understand it when you see fairly isolated stretches of metro railway, you know, such as we've seen in, for instance, Copenhagen, certain parts of China, certainly Sydney in Australia are going for what's called a GOA4 fully driverless system. But, you know, those systems, they're relatively simple, I think. Translating that into how you operate complicated interrelated networks, you know, such as, for instance, the railways south of the Thames, out of Victoria, Charing Cross, Waterloo, and so on, constitutes a much, much bigger task. And you know, I don't know the ins and outs, but actually, I, for one, I'm not sure that we should necessarily be trying to achieve a driverless future where, you know, human intervention is necessarily cut out of the loop. I'm not convinced that that's necessarily an improvement for the better.
So look, that's really fascinating. And Paul, really grateful for you to come on the show. This has been Lunch with Leon. And my guest today has been Paul Seller, who's the Managing Director at Ricardo Rail. Fascinating conversation today about rail and also decarbonisation, with a little side order of Brexit thrown in. So this has been Lunch with Leon. It's produced for itthub.net. Please go across to the website. You can see details of this and our other podcasts, and also lots of news and other information. So my thanks very much to Paul. We'll be back with another episode, hopefully next week. But in the meantime, Paul Seller, thank you very much.
Thanks, Leon.